Welcome to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Here's your host, Tom Temin.
That secretive Pentagon organization that's in charge of turning existing weapons systems into new warfighting concepts says it has a perfect track record so far. The military services have accepted all six of the technologies the Strategic Capabilities Office has offered up. As Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu reports, much of that success is not secret at all. It comes down to rapid prototyping.
The SCO has only been up and running since 2012, and its very existence was classified until last year. But within the Defense Department, demand for its services has skyrocketed. Its budget, which is paid by the other defense organizations it partners with, has grown from $50 million in 2012 to more than $900 million in 2017. Besides the six projects that have already transitioned to the military services, 28 more are in the works. Dr. Will Roper is the director of the Strategic Capabilities Office. He says the 6-for-6 track record is largely due to the fact that it insists on prototyping new weapons concepts itself before trying to convince the military services that they make sense on the battlefield.
When you've proved out a new technology, that's not the same as proving it as a program of record in the minds of the services. Services who are our partners on all SCO initiatives really need to see an operational demonstration before they want to take it and create a program of record. And they're wise to do that, because until you've seen it demonstrated operationally, how do you know that there's not some kind of, you know, bug under the hood that's going to end up driving cost, schedule, and performance? So when we're able to prototype and demonstrate one of our advanced concepts, every single time the services have taken them from us. So I really do believe it's the natural bridge from the world of science and technology into new programs, and it'll keep us from getting stuck with lemons in our programs of record. You want your failures to occur in prototyping, and so that's what we do.
The Pentagon says the SCO is its near-term response to a problem that started to dawn on senior officials about 5 years ago. The U.S. has had an unrivaled technological advantage over any other military on the planet for about a quarter century, but the gap is rapidly narrowing, partly because so many more technologies are commercially available, and partly because potential adversaries have had so much time to study and defeat the systems that have been in the U.S. military's inventory for decades.
If our military were a football team, analysts would say we have run our current playbook for too long. Rivals have watched decades of game film and exploited it. But whenever this happens in football, successful teams turn this into an advantage by creating trick plays. They run in their pass formations, they pass in their run formations, they reimagine their strengths rather than playing to their opponents. Creating the analog of trick plays for our military is the primary mission of SCO, reimagining its strengths, ships and submarines, aircraft, armored vehicles, using them in unforeseen and therefore hopefully uncontested ways. Regaining the element of surprise with systems we have today is our counter-counter move to defeat the advanced threats we face. And I'm pleased to say that many systems have been up to this task.
Over the longer term, the Pentagon is focused on building a new breed of weapon systems that can regrow its technological advantage, incorporating artificial intelligence, human-machine teaming, and autonomous systems in ways that instantaneously coordinate battle operations in the air, on the ground, on and under the sea, and in cyberspace. DoD generally refers to that project as the third offset strategy. But since the Federal Acquisition System is notoriously bad at building brand new weapon systems in a rapid fashion, SCO's job is to bridge the gap until the new systems can come online. Instead of a traditional acquisition office, it's DoD's version of MacGyver with a $1 billion budget, taking old weapon systems the military services already have in their inventories and finding new ways to use them that enemies won't expect and in ways that can be deployed pretty quickly. Roper says the office is trying to do that in several specific ways, including by finding new ways for weapon systems to work across domains that have traditionally been the province of the respective military services that are supposed to be in charge of air, land, or sea.
Blurring domains increases the complexity of fighting the United States. As an example of this, we are upgrading the Army's ATACMS missile to enable it to sink enemy ships in addition to its land strike duties. Teaming systems enables completely new warfighting concepts, ones that can keep operators safer. As an example of this, we are converting existing naval vessels into semi-autonomous ghost fleets that can shoulder dangerous missions without putting our sailors at risk.
In other cases, the office is working on ways to team a given weapon system with another one, or with commercial technologies, in ways that come together to bring a brand new capability to the battlefield, but that are also so complex that no mission commander could put it together on the fly. One such example is what the SCO calls the Ghost Fleet. The idea is to turn some of the Navy's smaller vessels into automated mobs that can go into dangerous territory to gather intelligence without putting sailors or high-value ships at risk of attack. A similar project, called Avatar, Qatar will use swarms of cheap, networked flying drones to help Air Force pilots in existing aircraft perform some of their missions without requiring them to actually fly into dangerous territory. Another project is trying to bring the concept of electromagnetic railguns, a concept the Navy's been working on in its laboratories for years, into the Army's inventory much more quickly than if the Army had started from scratch. Those hypervelocity guns would use the Paladin artillery that had been around since the 1990s as a new way to defend against incoming missiles. Roper says one reason that program is showing promise is because of the SCO's close relationship with the military's existing research laboratories.
Now, to get the most out of that prototyping, it's important that we make sure that lab-developed technology can be transitioned to the subsequent industry partner. An example of this, we've got a hypervelocity projectile program trying to take artillery to the next generation. The first articles were built in government laboratories. They've since been transitioned to industry. So it gets industry out of the starting blocks faster and keeps our scientists and engineers on the cutting edge.
But Roper says several of the office's projects aren't just a matter of reusing existing weapon systems. In some cases, it's looking for ways to combine those systems with new commercial technologies. In one case, the SCO is looking at ways to use the types of sensors that are now common in smartphones to help weapons determine their position in a hypothetical scenario where an enemy has managed to jam or disable the military's GPS systems. Another, called Perdix, aims to use commercially available 3D printers to make swarming micro-drones that can perform search missions in dangerous areas. Roper acknowledges those same technologies are available to potential adversaries, but he says other militaries aren't able to combine them in the ways the U.S. can or operate them at the same level of skill.
Though the approach often has cost and speed benefits, its core tenet, the need for change, is anchored in the department's greatest strength, one that cannot be easily stolen or copied. And that is our experienced operators who can do the unparalleled with today's systems and rapidly master any unconventional tactics we throw at them. As in football, it is people, not the plays, that ultimately win the game.
Jared Serbia, FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM.
Check out Jared's story and all of our DoD coverage at FederalNewsRadio.com. I'm Tom Temin.
Pentagon Solutions will return after these messages.
Wednesdays at 11 and 2, DoD reporter Jared Serbu hosts On DoD, an illuminating discussion with senior Defense Department managers about how DoD and all the branches meet their mission. From the budget to IT to material to workforce and readiness. On DoD with Jared Serbu, Wednesdays at 11 and 2 on FederalNewsRadio.com and 1500 AM. Download it anytime at FederalNewsRadio.com. Search On DoD.
With your Mayo Clinic Radio Health Minute, I'm Vivian Williams. Can you be fit and fat at the same time and still be heart healthy? Yes, says Dr. Stephen Kopetsky.
If you are normal weight, but you're out of shape, then your risk of heart attack is still pretty high. But if you are overweight, but you're physically fit, then your risk of heart attack goes down.
Dr. Kopetsky is not giving you carte blanche to start overeating, but he's emphasizing the importance of physical activity.
What if you are a normal weight, but you're not very fit? You lose all the benefit of being normal weight by being out of shape.
He says exercise, especially interval training, that's when you repeatedly go hard for 30 seconds or a minute and then rest, helps reduce blood pressure and triglycerides and helps keep your weight down. Because getting fit, no matter how much you weigh, will improve your heart health. For more information, talk with your doctor or visit mayoclinic.org.
The sun's heat usually needs to be used where it's collected because it isn't easily stored. But MIT engineering professor Jeff Grossman is preserving warmth through chemistry.
We've designed a new kind of molecule that when the sunlight strikes it, it twists around a little bit in such a way that it's storing heat. And it doesn't let go of the heat until you need it.
Grossman says the molecule can be made into solid materials of various sizes and colors that release bursts of heat when triggered by voltage, a certain light frequency, or a small heat pulse, and could be integrated into things like a car windshield or a jacket.
When I want a little bit of warmth, I can simply trigger it and the jacket will heat up.
Grossman says the solar heat battery could be recharged thousands of times and easily made through
a synthesis process that is cheap and scalable and we could be making tons of it.
More at nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Yatkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Technology inspires innovation. Innovation is a requirement for any business or agency. Listen Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 1 for Federal Tech Talk, hosted by John Gilroy. John gives you the latest on products that help breathe life into federal IT policy. Lively, entertaining, and totally informative, Federal Tech Talk airs Tuesday and Thursday afternoons at 1 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download at any time at federalnewsradio.com. Search Federal Tech Talk.
The initiative that enabled the creation of FBI-led task forces designed to mitigate the threat from the nation's most violent gangs marks its 25th anniversary. As the country's lead law enforcement agency responsible for aggressively investigating the most violent gangs that plague our communities, the FBI oversees 169 violent gang safe streets task forces. The task forces are composed of local, state, and federal law enforcement agencies that disrupt and dismantle prison, motorcycle and street gangs nationwide and beyond. Supervisory Special Agent Chris Tremblay says the task forces made nearly 6,000 arrests last year alone.
Our Safe Streets task forces are intelligence-driven, and our agents use sophisticated techniques to not only target these gangs, but also to disrupt and dismantle them.
Despite being smaller and less organized than more established criminal gangs, neighborhood gangs are currently the greatest threat in our nation's cities. With FBI This Week, I'm Molly Halpern of the Bureau.
You're listening to Pentagon Solutions on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Now here's your host, Tom Temin.
Few programs have bedeviled the Navy in recent years as much as the Littoral Combat Ship. Now Navy brass have decided to buy a dozen new ships they're calling a frigate, but it's basically a Littoral Combat Ship with some modifications. The Government Accountability Office finds there's too little information about the frigate for Congress to make informed decisions. Michelle Mackin is Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Issues at the GAO, and she joins me now with more. So does this mean, Michelle, that the Littoral Combat Ship is dead and they're replacing it?
Yes. So they will contract in this fiscal year, 2017, for the last two Littoral Combat Ships, and then pivot, as we call it, to this frigate acquisition, which is, as you noted, a modified Littoral Combat Ship with some capability improvement.
But the Littoral Combat Ship last orders end way short of what they originally had planned to buy, correct?
Yes, and this is what's been interesting. You know, it took two secretaries of defense to convince the Navy that changes needed to be made to this program, even though it was quite clear that it wasn't meeting needs, the last being in December 2015 when the secretary directed a reduced buy from 52 LCS to 40. And so now, as you pointed out, they'll be buying 12 of these frigates to close out the program.
So the frigates are the same basic hulls and the same basic manufacturers?
Exactly. Same shipyards. The plan is to down select to one shipyard. That's the current plan. But the proposals that the contractors will be submitting are based on the exact same Littoral Combat Ship hulls that are already in service. As I mentioned, there will be some improvements the Navy is seeking. One of the more significant will be, as you know, with the Littoral Combat Ship, they had to switch out the mission packages to provide the capability of the ship. For the frigate, the Navy's looking for more of a multi-mission capability, so that certainly will be an improvement.
Well, what's the difference? Because the other multi-mission was caused by switching out capabilities. They could, like, lower with a crane a new pieces of the ship on there. How does multi-mission differ from the way it was?
Well, in this case, what the Navy's hoping the contractors can do is to permanently mount some of the capabilities, like the surface and anti-submarine warfare equipment, onto the ship itself. So you won't have to do this switching out, as was the case with the LCS.
So sounds like a little, perhaps more reliability maybe, and less of a logistics tail for all the equipment and gear to take things on and off.
Potentially. I mean, I think our biggest concern here, as we have pointed out for several years now is that there seems to be a big rush to ask Congress to fund these ships before the detailed design is known, before even a cost estimate, a good cost estimate has been produced. You still, of course, have operational unknowns about the LCS itself. The operational testing hasn't been completed. And so by modifying these ships, there's still some unknowns that we believe should be resolved before this new potentially $9 billion investment in the frigate comes to pass.
Because the LCS had problems below decks, right, that were unrelated to that mission switch-out mechanism.
Right. It's had reliability issues. It's got some survivability problems that haven't been totally resolved or understood yet. We haven't seen the results of some of that testing. So those are significant unknowns in our opinion that, and the thing is we don't understand why the rush. Why not delay as we've recommended to Congress in this report? Give it another year so that you can understand what you're buying, you can understand more about the LCS itself, some of the issues that haven't been resolved yet, you can understand the capabilities that the frigate will provide. But the Navy intends to seek approval from Congress this fiscal year for a block buy contracting approach for 12 of these frigates. We believe that it would be better to hold off on that until next fiscal year.
We're speaking with Michelle Mackin, Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Issues at the GAO. So for this fiscal year means this week, possibly.
Possibly.
Because the fiscal year is already halfway done, and so 6 months, you're saying, doesn't seem like it would be that much of a difference in the long run.
I mean, we really don't understand the imperative. The Navy actually was on the right track and planned to award the contract for the frigate in fiscal year 19, but they accelerated that when the Secretary of Defense directed the reduced buy because, frankly, I think one of the big drivers is to keep some business going to the shipyards. And that's where we do have a bit of a difference of opinion with the Navy. If you look at the current shipyard workload, every LCS basically has been delayed in delivery. So there's still quite a bit of work at both shipyards. We don't understand the imperative to accelerate this frigate in light of all these significant unknowns that I've talked about.
This acceleration is coming from, when you say Secretary of Defense, you mean Jim Mattis, the current secretary.
The prior secretary is the one who directed the reduced buy. We'll have to see. The response to our report actually from DOD did recognize that there are some risks with the Navy's approach, but they'd still intend to go forward, albeit I will point out the response from DOD did say that they're going to keep an eye on it at the AT&L level and do some design reviews and make sure the cost estimates are in. So, we'll have to see how that plays out.
So what are you saying Congress needs to ask for specifically in terms of information?
Well, we're saying, number one, that Congress should not approve this block buy strategy this fiscal year until there's a good cost estimate in hand, until more is known about exactly what this frigate's going to look like. Proposals aren't in yet. Until some of the operational issues with the LCS itself have been better understood.
And as a frigate, the former LCS would still be used littorally, the Navy is saying?
That is our understanding, that the mission set will be very similar to the LCS. It's going to have some additional capability, as I said, but the mission set will be similar, yes.
Could this be perhaps the rush to the 12 maybe is because of a greater issue that the Trump administration wants to increase the Navy size?
I don't know, Tom. I mean, some of these decisions were made before that announcement. So.
And which shipyard is getting they haven't decided yet?
They haven't decided yet. As you know, there are two shipyards in contention here. What's interesting is if you go back in history to the LCS, there were plans to downselect to one shipyard, but then the pricing from both yards was pretty good under these block buy strategies, and so then the Navy decided to go ahead with two. So here we are again with the Navy poised to ask for a block buy authority you know, it's potentially possible that both shipyards will again come in with favorable pricing, and then, you know, we'll have to see how this plays out if there really will be a down select, as the prior Secretary of Defense had directed.
Michelle Mackin is Director of Acquisition and Sourcing Issues at the Government Accountability Office. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Find a link to her report and to this interview at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive. I'm Tom Temin.
You've been listening to Pentagon Solutions. Download this show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Search Pentagon Solutions.
There's all kinds of festivals coming up this month, or so says Marvin Bond. He's the editor of Recreation News. All right, Marvin, let's go.
The May issue of Recreation News is full of ideas. The Ale and History Beer Festival in Middletown, Virginia, takes place on May the 13th. So they have music, 60 beers to taste, and great views of the Cedar Creek battlefield. Find out more about that on page 15 of the May calendar of events.
Now, Marvin, my favorite kinds of festivals are music ones.
The Circa Blue Fest returns May 12th to 14th with loads of music and fun. You can find out more on page 5 in the West Virginia pullout section of the May Recreation News.
Now, you also have something in Virginia Beach, right?
The annual World War II air show by the Military Aviation Museum in Virginia Beach is May the 19th to the 21st. There are historic planes that perform above the beach, as well as reenactors and entertainment from the period of the 40s. Check it all out at MilitaryAviationMuseum.org.
Marvin Bond is the editor of Recreation News.
Join Federal News Radio Executive Editor Jason Miller for Ask the CIO, Thursdays at 10 and 2. Hear from your agency's top tech leaders on how they're using technology to change the way you meet your agency's mission. Ask the CIO is a must-listen for anyone who needs to know federal technology policy, implementation, and planning. Ask the CIO, Thursdays at 10 and 2 on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. Download at any time at federalnewsradio.com. Search Ask CIO.
The sun's heat usually needs to be used where it's collected because it isn't easily stored. But MIT engineering professor Jeff Grossman is preserving warmth through chemistry.
We've designed a new kind of molecule that when the sunlight strikes it, it twists around a little bit in such a way that it's storing heat. And it doesn't let go of the heat until you need it.
Grossman says the molecule can be made into solid materials of various sizes and colors that release bursts of heat when triggered by voltage, a certain light frequency, or a small heat pulse, and could be integrated into things like a car windshield or a jacket.
When I want a little bit of warmth, I can simply trigger it and the jacket will heat up.
Grossman says the solar heat battery could be recharged thousands of times and easily made through
a synthesis process that is cheap and scalable, and we could be making tons of it.
More at nae.edu/radio. With the National Academy of Engineering, Randy Yatkins, Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.